This week on The Right Side, the Alberta Auditor General's report is missed by the media. BC's tax and spend budget is praised while ignoring the economy, and faulty logic argues against political party unity. Meanwhile, Trudeau's India trip is plagued with numerous problems. This is The Right Side, episode 57, recorded Saturday, February 24th, 2018. Conspiracies and excuses. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. We're back this week, as we are each and every week.
It's good to be back, as always. We kind of had a bit of a slower news week, but that doesn't mean we don't have a lot to talk about, that's for sure. So, good to be here and being able to talk about what all happened this week.
Indeed, and sometimes the smaller news weeks do have the biggest surprises in them, and we definitely do have some of those this week. But in case you're joining us for the first time, The Right Side is a podcast that aims to cut through the bias and sensationalism in the mainstream media and provide you with the context needed to place you on the right side of the news. So we're going to begin this week with Alberta. And this was a rather interesting report here. The Auditor General in Alberta released its February report this past Thursday. And in the report, it highlighted where the government is doing well and some areas where the government could improve in terms of accountability. And, you know, that's something that you want to hear a lot from your government. You want to hear the Auditor General and see what they have to say about how the government is doing. And ordinarily, you would think that the media would also want to report on this. But this was a relatively minor story in the grand scheme of things. But at the end of the day, it actually packs some really interesting data in here that should have probably been talked about more. And, you know, if you were just browsing through the headlines, you might have seen that the February report included feedback on such topics as the government's class size initiative, which aimed to reduce class size. It also looked at investment into the new Sturgeon County refinery. Meal and travel expenses for the Ministry of Indigenous Relations was also mentioned, and also costs related to the Climate Leadership Plan. And of course, that is the piece of legislation that provides Alberta's carbon tax. So lots of things that could have been talked about here by the media. And, you know, the class size initiative was the one that was talked about the most. And, you know, rightly so, because there was a good deal of money associated with this. This initiative saw $2.7 billion spent to try to reduce class sizes, but there's ultimately no way of knowing if the initiative made a difference. That's what this report says, is that the government spent $2.7 billion to try and reduce class sizes, but there's no way the government knows if they're meeting their targets or if it's having any benefits. So if you look at it that way, that could be potentially $2.7 billion that are just wasted and gone into thin air, which is never good.
No, and you definitely want to see if that's actually going to make a difference, especially when you're spending that much money on education.
Oh, yeah, of course. This is primary education we're talking about here, so it's a big deal. And, you know, the report ultimately concluded with the uncertainty that if the level of investment right now going into the Sturgeon County refinery, the government doesn't know if it's enough. They don't know if they're overinvesting or they don't know if they're underinvesting. So once again, that's something that could be made better in this report. But, you know, that's what most of the media would have wanted to talk about this week, especially if you focused on outlets like CBC or Global. And the headline that came with this is that the class size initiative is the main story, with a minor focus on the Sturgeon refinery. But of course, each of these got equal coverage in the actual report themselves. And we were lucky if we got a sentence about the Climate Leadership Plan by these media outlets here. And, you know, it wasn't until the very end of some of these stories, you know, the fourth last paragraph in some cases, where we actually heard about the Climate Leadership Plan and how it's doing. And, you know, this led to the opposition once again doing the work of the mainstream media. On Facebook, the opposition surfaced relevant passages from the report, and here are some of them right now. From page 96, future reports should more clearly and completely describe the actual and expected costs of the Climate Leadership Plan and its initiatives and programs. Clear and complete information on the cost of the Climate Leadership Plan is missing. That's from page 101. While the report shows the expected emission reductions to 2030, it does not clearly state the expected and actual overall cost of the Climate Leadership Plan, and it does not state for each program the expected cost needed to achieve those reductions, also from page 101. And finally, it is more difficult to get a full picture of the total costs and benefits, and this comes from page 101 as well. And if you were a journalist and you were just looking at the executive summary of this report, you would get that very early on regarding the Climate Leadership Plan, where in the executive summary, it says, the desired results may not be achieved cost-effectively or at all. And this is, of course, referring to the Climate Leadership Plan, which, as I said, houses the carbon tax. And the carbon tax that we have here in Alberta now is one of the biggest fundamental changes to Alberta tax policy that we've seen in a very, very long time. And you would think that the media would want to report on how the government is doing and whether the Climate Leadership Plan and the associated carbon tax is actually working. They don't, and you know, I think we know why at this point. It's the media cherry picking which stories they talk about, much the same way they cherry picked facts in last week's CTV news story regarding Patrick Brown. And what's effectively stated here is that the government has no issue taking money from Albertans for some unknown cost of doing so in pursuit of the climate change plan, which may not actually work at the end of the day, which when you flip that around on its head, it basically means it's a climate leadership plan focused on the carbon tax to just have a carbon tax for the sake of having a carbon tax, because the government doesn't know if it's going to work and they have no way of measuring what its actual outcomes are at this point in time. So you can kind of see where this report is going here. And let's just take a moment to remember why this is such a big deal. And that's because everyone in Alberta pays for this tax. You pay for the tax when you buy from the grocery store because those groceries are brought to the grocery store by truck, by train potentially. And, you know, you're also paying for your own electricity. And the grocery store is also paying for heating and electrical bills as well. So practically everything that you buy inside of a store these days is going to be affected by the carbon tax. And when you put it in that perspective, the Climate Leadership Plan and the carbon tax are something that really should be taken care of in the sense of an Auditor General's report. And just the very fact that the government has no idea of how much it's going to cost to implement or if they'll hit those margins is really, really bad. Now, for context here, the CBC waited until the fourth last paragraph to mention the Climate Leadership Plan and only mentioned that the auditors found it has no overall implementation plan with nothing on the unknown costs. Now, when it gets worse is that CTV and Global failed to mention the Climate Leadership Plan at all. It's not until you get to such outlets like the Edmonton Journal, 660 News in Calgary, or the news website from Morinville, morinvillenews.com, that you actually hear about the carbon tax and the Climate Leadership Plan and the woes that this brings to this Auditor General's report. So you can see that there's clearly some selective reporting done here by the big media outlets in the major cities of Edmonton and Calgary, just by the fact here that we had to go to Morinville to find some of this information. And once again, credit to the Edmonton Journal piece, where they do actually have a dedicated section on this, summarizing the executive summary of the report. So,
yeah, and I think that just highlights a failing of big media to be able to report on stories, is because when they share stories, all of the failings of an article will be republished across all media outlets that are owned by the same company. So when it comes down to it, it comes down to specific journalists from smaller outlets that'll actually dig a bit deeper and find out the real facts. And that's why you can't just rely on the bigger outlets to be able to provide you with the news anymore. You have to go to smaller places just to be able to find out what's going on in your own city. And that's something that's not very good, I think.
Yeah. And when the carbon tax brings in that much money and it touches that much money and that kind of money is flowing into and out of government, people have a right to know about whether or not it's working and if it's achieving the targets that it set out to achieve. So this is a big blunder that should have received a lot more coverage than it actually did. All right, what do you got for BC this week?
So in BC, BC government ended up releasing its spring budget on Tuesday, and we talked a little bit about that last week when I went over the throne speech, and that was among other things that we talked about last week, like the raising of the minimum wage that's going to be happening. Now, as mentioned, the biggest priorities for the NDP this spring were housing, healthcare, and childcare, and they ended up spending quite a bit of money on that. In doing so, to cover the costs, they raised taxes pretty much everywhere else. So let's start off with the medical service plan premiums. Now, they were going to originally be eliminated in January 2020, and there was a lot of speculation as to how that could be achieved affordably. And now that we know what the answer actually is, and that's big businesses and smaller businesses too will be paying a new payroll tax directly to subsidize all workers' premiums. Now, this works out to 1.95% if their payroll is over $1.5 million a year, and there's going to be a reduced rate if they're between $500,000 and $1.5 million, and none at all if they're under $500,000. Now, that said, it isn't actually hard to reach that level if you employ even just 15 people in a business, because you have to think that each of those will probably earn at least anywhere between $20,000 to $50,000 a year. Even just a little bit more than the minimum wage. So they're categorizing people with just 15 people as being a big business. So lots of small business groups are up in arms about this, as bigger chain stores like Walmart, mining companies, telecoms, and banks are being lumped into the same category as medium-sized stores, such as a local grocery store, and they're all going to have to pay the same rate. Now, this is something that Greater Vancouver Board of Trade, the president and chief executive officer, Ian Black, he mentions that the payroll tax will have a significant impact on businesses already coping with increases in the minimum wage, a carbon tax hike, and a higher corporate tax rate. He says, quote, "So now to hit the small business community with an additional 2% payroll tax, there is only one thing they can do, and that's hire less people or don't give raises to the existing ones," he said. He also pointed out that many large corporations already pay their employees MSP premiums as a workplace benefit. And since MSP is being phased out, the new payroll tax will just replace it with little net impact, and it will just add cost to smaller businesses. So that's one way that the new NDP budget will be harming small businesses and employees that work for those businesses, and it's not really been talked about that much in the media. What has been talked about was the huge childcare plan that was brought out, and Finance Minister Carol James said that the budget marks the beginning of a universal childcare plan, but she actually made no mention in the legislature about the NDP's campaign promise of $10 a day childcare. Instead, they seem to have abandoned that, and she said that the province will spend $182 million this year and more than $1 billion over the next 3 years to make childcare more affordable and to create 22,000 new childcare spaces. And the plan includes a new affordable childcare benefit that the government says will reduce costs by up to $1,250 per month per child for a family earning less than $45,000 a year. And Green Party leader Andrew Weaver is on board with this budget and is especially thrilled with the childcare plan. So for anyone who's thinking that the budget might be voted down, sadly, you'll be out of luck. Now, when it comes to housing, the government has introduced a large number of tax measures which are intended to cool the rapidly rising costs in the housing market, but will also undoubtedly be using the money to pay for affordable housing as well, which they have mentioned in their throne speech. So the government will introduce legislation this year to create a new speculation tax on residential property, which is aimed at foreign and domestic owners who don't pay income tax in BC. Now, the tax, which which already applies in Vancouver, will also apply in Victoria, Nanaimo, and other major centers around the province. It'll be $5 per $1,000 of assessed value in 2018 and rise to $20 per $1,000 in 2019. So that's going to be based on the assessed...
Doesn't seem like very much.
No, it's not very much to begin with, but it'll end up being a little bit more, especially when you consider that assessed values are going to go up quite a bit. They're making it seem like it's not going to be very much, but if your home is assessed at $1 million, you have to remember that you're going to have to pay quite a bit more for that, because if you times it out, and that's going to end up being $2,000 that's going to add on to your property taxes that you're going to have to pay at the end of the year. And as we all know, at BC, $1 million home is not actually that much.
Not very hard to anymore. Find.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in addition to this, the government will also increase the foreign buyer's tax from 20% from the 15% that the BC Liberals put in. Now, this is going to be this was effective Wednesday, and they're also going to expand it beyond Metro Vancouver to the Capital Regional District down here in Victoria. They're also going to bring that to Nanaimo, the Fraser Valley, and the Regional District of Central Okanagan. So that's going to affect basically most of the population in BC. So the property transfer tax on properties above $3 million will increase to 5% from 3%, and that change also took place on Wednesday. So the budget also increases the fuel tax on clear gasoline and diesel in the Capital Regional District to 5.5 cents per liter from 3.5 cents. So that's an extra 2 cents that we're going to be paying in gas for anyone who owns a car. Now, this is going to be effective April 1st. And the tax, especially in the Victoria area, is expected to raise another $7 million per year for the Victoria Regional Transit Commission. And the budget also froze fares on all major BC Ferries routes, which was a campaign promise that they ended up fulfilling now. So, all in all, it turns out that it's going to be a very taxing budget in more ways than one. So, how is this received in the media? It turns out that the Globe and Mail's Gary Mason described it in his very one-sided article as, quote, "The BC NDP ignores elites and tables budget for those who need help." So this is a quote directly from Mason's article. "How much better the New Democrats were at tapping into and understanding the profound frustration and anger many British Columbians were feeling was on full display in this week's budget. The government designed a fiscal plan that addressed the long-ignored needs of average folks over the wants and wishes of a corporate and development community beloved and coddled by the former government. This is why this budget is going to be difficult for the opposition Liberals to criticize, try as they might. It addresses a fundamental failing of their government to demonstrate even the tiniest bit of compassion and sympathy for the average person and their workaday lives. It was a budget that focused attention away from the elites and the bond rating agencies and toward people who genuinely need help." End quote. So Mason writes a lot more about how the Liberals were out of touch with the electorate. But you have to remember that they were still the party with the most seats after the election. They created a strong economy, the strongest economy in the country, of course. They encouraged a lot of investment in the province, and they lowered the unemployment rate to the lowest in Canada, yet they're still labeled as out of touch and working with the elites. So overall, he misses the mark on this one. While the budget does help those with the lowest income, it still increases taxes in some way on everyone. And we have to remember that increasing taxes on corporations will just usually end up passing on the cost to either employees or the customers who buy their products. So Mason also says that, quote, "In a province where income inequality is so pronounced, any move by the government to ask the wealthy to pay a bit more will be welcomed by the masses, not denounced." However, there's actually a lot of people that are noticing items in the budget that are not overly talked about in the media, and a lot of them are asking questions. As Mike Smith of the Vancouver Province writes, quote, James delivered a budget speech in the legislature that completely ignored forestry, mining, oil and gas development, fishing, aquaculture, and energy generation. There was not even a single mention of any of these lifeblood BC industries. Not one. That's pretty shocking. By focusing solely on social spending and raising taxes, the NDP runs the risk of further alienating the rural north, interior, and coast of BC, where unfairly snubbed resource industries make the lavish spending possible. End quote. And that makes a fairly good point here, is that a lot of this is based on the NDP's base out of the Vancouver Island and in the Lower Mainland, and the rest of the province seems to be ignored. And this was something that was talked about in the election, when only a few NDP MLAs were even elected outside of those areas. And it seems like that's holding true today as well when we come to the budget.
And, you know, this makes all the difference because this is a very NDP budget, and the Mike Smith piece covers it well because, you know, you have to look at where the money is coming in from. There's only a set amount of money that you can get by taxing the populace, because the more you tax the populace, the less money that they will actually have to spend. And if they don't have money to spend, that defeats the entire purpose of taxation, at least on the businesses front. And when it comes to the corporate tax side, well, it's been well proven that increasing the corporate tax rate is a way to cool down investment in an economy. And the very fact that this is being done in this budget is not going to spur much new investment. And as we've talked about many times before here on the right side, any new investment that comes into a jurisdiction, whether it be BC, Alberta, or Canada, is ultimately good for everyone because it's revenue generating and allows the government to fund programs and services that people like, and programs and services from this point of view that the NDP seem to like as well. And that just headline that we had in the Globe and Mail was just utterly shocking with this.
Yeah, exactly. Especially because any new investment that comes into the province, not only is it revenue generating, it's also job creating. And that's something that's really good for a lot of people that don't have the income to be able to sustain a lot of these taxes that come through. It's because the only way to pay off taxes, after all, is to have money to pay it off.
Right.
The only way to have money is to have a job.
And, you know, they mark $45,000 a year, but what are you going to be able to do in Vancouver with $45,000 a year unless you have a multifamily income?
Yeah, you could wait 25 years and only then will you be able to buy an apartment. I mean, in Vancouver, that's not very much, but they seem to be really with this budget, from what I've noticed, is that they're helping people with the very lowest of incomes. And that's a good thing. We need to help the people that that need help the most. But the problem is that they're ignoring pretty much everyone else, all of the middle family incomes that could use a hand as well, especially in the areas where their money does not go as far as in other places of the province would. And that's something that's not been touched on in the media, and something else that wasn't touched on in the media, other than in the Mike Smith piece in the Vancouver Province, was that a lot of these industries and the economy in general was not talked about at all. And all of this was introducing a bunch of new taxes and introducing a bunch of new spending. It didn't have anything to do with investment, didn't have anything to do with growing the economy or even jobs, which you would think that the NDP would want to have more jobs, but this is not something that they're going for.
Yep. And, you know, we also talked about the minimum wage last week as well. That's going to be an issue going forward, and compound with that with the budget. I think the economists are going to have something interesting to say come June or July once the initial reports come running in. So,
and we will cover those then when they do.
All right. So moving on to Canada now. This is a rather interesting piece in the opinion section from the National Post by Andrew Coyne with the title, "Divide and Conquer in Canadian Politics? It Seems Maybe Not." So as you might know, divide and conquer is a strategy that many like to use in the political spectrum to win. And, you know, you have to ask with this, do people really understand what divide and conquer means after reading this article? Because the way this headline is phrased and what it says immediately after the headline is that perhaps the Canadian left has succeeded, not in spite of its division into two or more parties, but because of it. So Andrew Coyne with this postulates that the appearance of the CCF, which was the precursor to the NDP, before this, the Liberals only won 17 of 17 elections, and ultimately over the average of that time period, which is prior to 1930, trailed the Conservatives by an average of 1.6%. And he says that after the NDP appeared, the Liberals then succeeded to win 16 of 25 elections with an average of 3.3% on their victory margin ahead of the Conservatives, whether that be the Progressive Conservatives or a combined vote of the Reform and Progressive Conservatives or just the Conservative Party of Canada. And, you know, this is in large part the totality of the argument here. It's expanded a bit by saying that maybe the presence of more center-left parties like the Greens and the Bloc could have potentially enlarged the voting base that parties like the Liberals enjoy. But what's ultimately missed by this is that the Greens and the Bloc are both issue-based parties and in the past have moved around the political spectrum. Like, for example, the Green Party wasn't always seen as on the left. One of the previous Green Party leaders before Elizabeth May actually almost sounded like a fiscal conservative with the environmentalist aspect. So it's also argued here that the NDP pushes debate and therefore moves the political center to the left in Canada. That is where the majority of people are going to find themselves. And this, he says, creates more space for the Liberals to respond, allowing them to gain more votes in election and therefore winning more seats. Then he argues the opposite for the Conservatives, that since 2004, while ending the vote split that existed on the right between the Progressive Conservatives and the Reform Party, having one party on the right did not alter the political balance and change the conversation in Canada. And, you know, the biggest way to knock this argument flat to the floor is to have a look at the 1984 election in which Brian Mulroney won 211 seats with over 50% of the vote. And this, of course, happened because the voter base for Mulroney's PCs expanded to not only include the West, but conservatives from southern Ontario, but also Quebec nationalists. And, you know, since Mulroney, no conservative leader has tailored their message to Quebec. And some argue that such a victory today, even with the NDP in existence, is still indeed possible. And what's more, with this conversation, when you look at the conservative ideas, he's saying that new conservative ideas don't occur, but these ideas still appear each and every year at their party conventions or at third-party conferences like the Manning Networking Conference each spring in Ottawa. And these ideas of these new ideas do exist in the party at the grassroots level, but in the off chance that they appear in the national media, they're lambasted for the content of the ideas themselves by the media and those who are against those ideas. And this gains traction many, many times. And conservative policies in Canada are somewhat drawn back, unlike the US, because if their ideas were on full display at a policy convention, as was the case with the NDP convention last weekend, who now want a national minimum wage, universal pharmacare, universal dental care, and legalization of all drugs for everyone. And this is not, of course, prescription drugs. This is referring to hard drugs. They want decriminalization of drugs. They would be subsequently picked apart by the media and shunned. And, you know, two big ideas recently that received this treatment during the past conservative leadership race were both, one, having a look at abortion laws and putting some kind of regulation or restriction on them. And the media was in utter dismay that this idea was even being talked about, even though polls that have been done in Canada say that greater than 50% of people in Canada favor some kind of regulation on abortion. Not necessarily an outright ban, but maybe just some kind of limitations or some formal definition of what the law should be. Because recall, we've talked about this before here on the podcast, that legislation is not defined in Canada. Another was Kelly Leach's talk on immigration and the need to have a better understanding of who's coming into our country and make sure that they understand Canadian values. The media didn't like this either, even though that Canadian values is something that was defined and enshrined in Pierre Trudeau's repatriation of the Constitution in 1982, Canadian values. So, you know, while Andrew Coyne might believe this, it's his industry that's ultimately responsible for this view and bringing down these ideas whenever they appear because they don't fit their worldview. And I think we saw that this past summer in the show that we did after the Conservative leadership race with Andrew Scheer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of issues that are being talked about where we really should just have an honest discussion about it. And when it looks at when it comes to take a look at abortion, a lot of people say, "Oh no, you can't touch that issue. It's too dangerous. You know, you might upset a lot of people." But I think a lot of people that are in favor of some regulation on abortion, most of it is because they don't want gendered abortion, which is where if you have the wrong gender of a baby, then they go to have an abortion so that they can get the right one. A lot of people don't want that to be able to happen. And a lot of people don't want late-term abortion either, where the baby is mostly formed in the womb. And it's basically after 40 weeks, I believe, is usually the cutoff for the third trimester. And a lot of people think that there should be regulation on that. So I think even if you feel like most of the time abortions should be legal, I think it's fair that there should be some regulation on it. But if you
try just a discussion on it, you know,
or even just. Yeah, exactly. Even just a discussion on what should happen. But anytime this comes up in any sort of leadership race or convention or something like that, the media just pops on it right away and they say conservatives in favor of abortion legislation. And we saw that in the last leadership race, and it tuned a lot of people out just because they cherry picked their quotes and their titles. And that's something that the media really should be doing a bit more on, is actually trying to further the discussion that's happening instead of trying to shut it down.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you just have to look at what actually happened with the immigration system last year and all the people crossing illegally into Canada. And the fact that that happened proves we do actually need a discussion on the way the immigration system works and, you know, what might be happening in the modern age of terrorism in regards to Canadian values. And, you know, that kind of discussion was also shot down as well. And for that position in the race, Kelly Leach was touted as one of the most extreme candidates, when in reality she was having a discussion with the membership, and you know, the media didn't like that.
So mm-hmm.
We'll just have to wait and see what happens here, but it's going to take someone with the ability to say what needs to be said and have these discussions to bring these ideas out into the forefront, and maybe, you know, just not necessarily go through the mainstream media, but bypass the mainstream media in general. We're in an age where that's possible. And, you know, if the media is not careful, they're going to find themselves on the side of the road, covering the story from the sidelines and not being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what have we got for our firing line? I have a feeling we're going to talk about something that's very interesting and something we had to go to international media to find once again.
Indeed. So the firing line is our usual segment for covering a story that either was not covered very well in the media, was either covered too much, or perhaps was just covered by the wrong angle, or a lot of places. In a lot of cases, it was the biggest news story of the week. And in this case, I think that was it. And even before the week started, like just after recording last week's episode, the two of us were talking about Trudeau's upcoming visit to India. And given his disastrous trade trip to China that happened in December, we were wondering what would happen and what would go wrong. Because at this point, it's given that if Trudeau goes on a state trip, something will go wrong. And
yeah,
it appears that we couldn't even begin to predict the myriad of issues.
And I believe I said to you, let's not talk about the India trip unless something happens.
Exactly. And it appears we couldn't even begin to predict all of the issues that have cropped up with what is being called as Trudeau's bangle bungle. Now let's leave the Trudeau family's Indian fashion choices aside for a moment, and let's ask one simple question. Just how is it that a man convicted of attempted murder and terrorism can be invited to a dinner reception with our Prime Minister? So it actually seems very easily. After meetings with Omar Khadr and Joshua Boyle, it seems now we have another one to add to the list. So the man in this case is Jaspal Attwal, and he is a man convicted of attempted murder and terrorism, and is a former member of an illegal Sikh separatist group advocating for an independent Khalistan, which is a region in northeastern India with a large Sikh population. The International Sikh Youth Federation was declared a terrorist organization by the Canadian government in the early 1980s, and its members had ties to Sikh extremists who orchestrated the deadly 1985 terrorist bombing of the Air India Flight 182 off of Ireland that killed a total of 329 people, including 268 Canadian citizens. Now, Jaspal Attwal's conviction stems from an incident in 1986, shortly after the Air India bombing. He was one of four men who shot and wounded an Indian cabinet minister, Malkiat Singh Sidhu, on Vancouver Island. And this was Sidhu was visiting Gold River, BC, for his nephew's wedding, and Attwal was convicted of attempted murder for his part in the attack, and he even admitted what he did. And he ended up serving a very minimal amount of jail time, and he was later paroled. Now, Sidhu, the Indian cabinet minister, was ended up being murdered in India just a couple months later, and the attackers in that case were never caught. And Attwal was actually also charged with a near-fatal 1985 attack on now former BC Premier and Liberal MP Ujjal Dosanjh, who was a vocal opponent of the Sikh separatist movement. But Attwal was later acquitted of this, and he says that he had nothing to do with it. Now, more recently, in 2010, Attwal was found to be a part of an automobile fraud ring that cheated ICBC by falsely reporting vehicles as stolen, changing their identification numbers, and then reselling them. Attwal was a car salesman at the time and helped convert one of the stolen vehicles a judge had found, and he ended up losing an appeal in 2012. And at the time, Attwal had a position on a federal Liberal Riding Association executive in Surrey, which he had held since at least March 2011. Now, Gulzar Chima, who is a former BC Liberal cabinet minister, told the Sun, Vancouver Sun, that Attwal had been active for both the federal and provincial Liberal parties and would attend fundraisers for the federal Liberals that Chima organized, including one attended by then Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff. And Attwal has made other attempts to insert himself into federal and provincial politics. Aside from this week's photos with Gregor Trudeau and Infrastructure Minister Amarjeet Soshi, older photos have surfaced of Attwal posing with prominent Canadian politicians, though dates and locations are not always clear. Photos shared on social media show Attwal with Trudeau at a Liberal Party event in Vancouver in May 2015, as well as with Public Services Minister Carla Quattro, Ignatieff, and Brampton Liberal MP Sonia Sidhu. An older photo, which Attwal posted to his Facebook profile in January 2013, shows him with a longer-haired Trudeau before he was elected Liberal leader. So it's clear that he's had ties to the Liberals going back for quite a while. So let's fast forward to about a week ago. It appears that the Liberal MP for Surrey Centre, Randeep Sarai, submitted Attwal's name in a list to be added to a guest list for a dinner reception formal event, which was hosted by the Canadian High Commissioner Thursday in Delhi. Now, Attwal had already attended at least one event tied to the Trudeau visit and was pictured with Sophie Gregoire Trudeau and Infrastructure Minister Amarjeet Soshi. And now the Liberal government has been quick to describe the incident as just a mistake caused by a backbencher. However, it's hard to call this a mistake when such a man was known to the party for a long time beforehand. In a statement, Sarai said that he acted alone and, quote, should have exercised better judgment. Now, reports from the India media says that the Indian government is now looking into Atwal obtained a visa for the trip. An official spokesperson for the Indian government had no explanation for how Atwal managed to get his name removed from the list of people banned from traveling to the country, or any information to offer on the documents he used to get into India, but he said that the government is investigating further. It appears that Atwal apparently traveled outside of the PM's delegation to India on his own, and he said that he traveled to Mumbai on business for Media Waves, which is a Surrey online radio station. Now, after this had happened, there are two ways that you go about this. You can either admit what's wrong and then move on from there, or you can make a very confusing decision. So governments actually received heavy criticism for how they've handled the aftermath of the Atwal incident. According to David Aiken of Global News, the PMO brought out one of the most senior members of the civil service, someone who is one of the handful of bureaucrats privy to literally all the state secrets of our national security agencies, to engage in frantic damage control. And this is from Aiken's article. Quote, after insisting that any journalist who wanted to listen to what this individual had to say could not name this person, the government tasked the bureaucrat with peddling what must be one of the most bizarre conspiracy theories ever advanced by Canadian government, that Jaspal Atwal, the terrorist invited by the Liberals to Mumbai, may have been planted there by the Indian government, or maybe by Indian security agencies, or perhaps by factions in the Indian government. And this was quickly brought up by CBC in an article where they thought that they repeated what the civil service member said, and saying that it was probably a rogue element to try and make the Trudeaus look like Sikh separatist sympathizers. But Aiken blew a hole right through that idea that Atwal was placed by anyone other than the Liberals. He said, quote, among other things, in order to have this theory work, to accept the idea that some third party in India arranged Atwal to be present at the PM's Mumbai event, one has to accept the idea that Randeep Sarai, who is the Member of Parliament for Surrey Centre, was also in on the scam. Now, Sarai has refused to answer questions about his role in this affair, but we do know that Atwal was on the invitation list at Sarai's request. So to come back to the conspiracy theories, Indian agents looking to show up Trudeau had to somehow convince Sarai to be their willing stooge and to issue the invitations to Atwal. Secondly, we must believe that Sarai happily took it upon himself to recommend Atwal for an invitation with no clue about his background, despite articles in the Vancouver Sun as recently as 2012 about Atwal's criminal connections and Liberal background, articles that forced other Liberals at the time to resign their positions with local constituency associations. And this also mentions that Sarai, a lawyer and real estate developer who described himself prior to his election as active in electoral politics at all levels, and who was called upon by local media outlets in Surrey to talk about regional politics, that did not ever run into Atwal is impossible to accept.
So the government's saying this is a conspiracy theory.
They're basically saying that this is a conspiracy by rogue factions of the Indian government to paint the Trudeau government as being sympathizing to Sikh extremists. But as we can see here, Atwal was known to the federal Liberals a long time beforehand. He's got so many pictures with prominent federal Liberals. You just have to look at them. You have to look at all the events where he was a riding executive, that he's worked with the party for many, many years now. And this can't just be considered a simple mistake. This had to have been planned by them. Now, the Atwal debacle adds insult to injury for Trudeau's India tour, which was already overshadowed by the cold shoulder the Indian government has given Trudeau. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi did not welcome Trudeau at the airport, as he has done for many other foreign leaders, and he did not accompany Trudeau to his home state of Gujarat. Now, the snub likely comes as a result of Trudeau's failure to denounce and condemn Sikh extremists and Khalistan terrorists in Canada. Now, as we covered at the time on the right side, in April 2017, Trudeau attended a pro-Khalistan parade that featured shrines dedicated to Sikh terrorists, including Talwinder Parmar, who was the ringleader of the Air India bombing. And Trudeau was photographed in front of a Khalistan independence flag, and at the time, that move was seen as very disrespectful to the Indian government. Now, as if all that wasn't bad enough, Trudeau's visit also garnered ridicule among international media for his choreographed, fake, tacky, and annoying wardrobe of traditional outfits, as was described by the Daily Mail of United Kingdom. And these traditional outfits were what he and his family wore on each of the 3 days of the visit, and were publicized very heavily by lots of photographers. And after heavy criticism from the Indian media, such as, quote, "even Indians don't dress like that," and being accused of pandering, he very quickly changed into wearing a suit for the rest of the visits. So it's hard to see how Trudeau could have messed up back-to-back visits with both of the top two countries by population so badly, but here we are.
And also not to mention here, or not to forget that, you know, he brought his entire family on this. And if you look at the social feeds and you look at the reporting that's done on the photos, if it weren't for the whole debacle prior to the clothing, you would think that he was there on a family vacation on the taxpayer's dime as well. And that's also something I'm sure lots of questions will be asked about going forward with this. So like you said, two of the largest countries by population, and we have state visits that are just visits in general, not state visits, that didn't turn out exactly how they were supposed to. So I guess the question to ask then is, what happens next?
Yeah, where is he going to visit next, and what is he going to mess up? Because I think at this point, it's a given. Like, we'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt, but he's kind of messed up a few times now, and we have to wonder what's next for him, and what else is he going to do, and how is he going to fix our relationship with the Indian government after this?
Yeah,
there's lots of questions to remain after this. I think more than have been answered by the actual visit itself.
Yeah, and India is a very key country because, you know, just like with China, we have the potential to deal tons in terms of trade with these two countries and tons in terms of energy. But if we're flubbing up these visits that are, you know, laying the groundwork for potential future deals with them, that's not good. And that's something that should definitely be rectified going forward.
Exactly.
Well, that leads us into our word of the week. And the word of the week we're going for this week is conservative, which is defined as holding traditional attitudes and values and cautious about change or innovation, typically in relation to politics or religion. And, you know, you might be thinking conservative. Okay, that's here. That's the name of one of our political parties federally here in Canada. We also talked about the Andrew Coyne article in our Canada segment, and the idea is that conservatives' ideas aren't making their way to the forefront, and that's all well and true. But I think we can also extend this to the firing line segment, where if you act conservatively in your interactions with world countries or world leaders, rather, you can get a lot more done than if you are constantly pushing the limit, which it feels like Trudeau is doing here. So perhaps a little bit more on the conservative side of the attitude and conduct from the Trudeau government would be warranted on future state trips to China and India.
Mm-hmm. Especially to places where their culture is so much different than Canada. And you have to remember that to places like this, a lot of expected practices are not seen as such in Canada. And when you're going over there, you have to respect their rules, so to speak, in how to conduct yourself. And it doesn't seem that Trudeau is making a lot of effort to do that. What he's doing is seems to be dressing himself in the traditional garb and then making a lot of photo ops about this, but that doesn't really come off as being sincere.
One would wonder what would happen if he went to Africa.
Exactly, right? I mean, is he going to try and blend in there with, you know, a bunch of different ways to do that, of course.
Anyways, I believe that's it for this episode of The Right Side. If you guys want full show notes for this episode, you can find that at rightsidenews.ca. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and YouTube at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes and rightsidenews.ca/YouTube. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca. With that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we'll always be here to make sure that we cut out the bias and sensationalism that you see in the media, and to make sure that you're on the right side of the news. So with that, we will see you next week, and have a good week, everyone.